Good evening. Tonight it is my official task, my distinct honor, and my great pleasure to introduce to you the person and work of Carol Lyons Myers, the 122nd President of the Society. These introductions are by no means an easy task, given the multiple and distinguished achievements and recognitions garnered over the course of many years by the scholars who have received the enormous privilege of serving the Society in this capacity. Tonight is no exception. I will try my best. Professor Myers enters the world of biblical studies, broadly writ, in the 1960s and 70s. Upon graduation from Wellesley College in 1964, where she earned a Bachelor of Arts degree with a major in biblical history, literature, and interpretation, she went on to pursue graduate studies at Brandeis University in Near Eastern and Judaic Studies, with a concentration in biblical studies, receiving her doctorate in 1975. Immediately afterwards, she joined the Department of Religion at Duke in 1976, where she has remained a member of the faculty until today and is the May Grace Wilson Professor of Religion in the Department of Religion. Professor Myers thus belongs to that generation of academics who have been forever and indelibly marked in one way or another by these tumultuous but vibrant years. These scholars were formed socially and culturally in the momentous decade of the 1960s. This was a time of tectonic political transformations across the globe as liberation movements multiplied and flourished across the Third World, with the heightening of the Cold War between the First and Second Worlds as backdrop. This was also a time of widespread social unrest in the United States, as civil rights movements proliferated and strengthened throughout the country, with the intensification of the Vietnam War as background. They then entered the academy in the crucial decade of the 1970s. This was a time, in the wake of the social and cultural turmoil of the 1960s, when the world of the university began to undergo, across its entire disciplinary spectrum, radical changes in its ranks, in the faces and voices of its members, as well as in its discourses, in the methods and theories of its critical repertoire. Religious studies in general, and biblical studies in particular, proved no exception to these developments. In fact, such a turn in the field may be symbolically identified with the launching of the journal Semeia in 1974, 40 years ago next year. It was precisely at this time, midpoint in the 1970s, that Professor Myers brings her doctoral studies to completion and embarks on her professional and scholarly career. To my mind, she represents an ideal signifier of the times, a product of and an agent in such years of transformation. In terms of faces and voices, she belongs to the first generation of women who break into the patriarchal world of the academy and the field of studies. In terms of method and theory, she stands with that circle of scholars who begin to reach out to other fields of study, such as the social sciences and feminist studies, for grounding and inspiration in the study of biblical antiquity. I should like to expand on these dimensions. The 1960s witnessed, among a variety of movements for civil rights, the rise of the second feminist movement, with a goal of social justice for women throughout society and culture, which were perceived as gender to the core. A major aim of the movement was to increase the presence of women in colleges and universities, in baccalaureate programs, in professional and graduate studies, and ultimately in academic faculties and administrations. In this regard, the story of Professor Myers is one that is well known and widely shared by that first generation of women. This story she retraces step by step in a splendid interview published in Wellesley, the alumni magazine for the college, in the late 1990s. First, while in doctoral studies at Brandeis, not only was she invariably the only woman in her classes, but also all of her professors were male. Subsequently, in her early years at Duke, she was the only woman on the faculty in the Department of Religion. Further, as a beginning scholar and teacher, the problematic of gender played no part at all in the curriculum. The first change in this regard, she notes, came when she was asked by a number of her male colleagues to develop a course on gender, which she proceeded to do and to which the title of Women in the Bible was assigned. In the intervening 40 years, the presence and status of women in the academy and the field have changed drastically, even if much remains to be done yet, as it certainly does. For such changes as have occurred, however, the figure of Carol Lyons Myers has been pivotal, a pioneer who broke through the material barriers of gender and made it easier for later generations to follow suit. Such a path-breaking role has been honored in any number of occasions. I shall mention but two given to her by her alma mater, the Severinghouse Award in 1991 for outstanding contributions to religion, and the Alumni Achievement Award in 1999 for her work in archaeology and biblical studies. With the 1970s came the first moves toward a reconceptualization and formulation of the field through critical engagement with the human sciences and the social sciences. This was a direction, specifically along the lines of sociocultural criticism, that Professor Myers resolved to undertake early on in her career. In the interview for Wellesley magazine, she notes how she soon realized that such an interdisciplinary approach was of the essence in addressing the questions that her work on the texts and remains of antiquity had begun to raise. To this end, she recalls how, in the early 1980s, she applied for and was awarded an independent study and research fellowship from the National Endowment for the Humanities, one of the many fellowships and grants that she has received over the years, that made it possible for her to spend a year at Oxford University pursuing studies in social anthropology. Later on, in a study for a volume for which she also served as co-editor, Community, Identity, and Ideology, she reflects on the impact of the social sciences on the study of the Hebrew Bible. She notes the explosive expansion of such research, which she traces to the impetus and legacy of the social unrest of the 1960s and 70s. She also highlights a key dimension of such interdisciplinary conjunction, approaching ancient Israel as a social entity by way of patterns of social organization and economic realities, an entity that stands in complex and conflicted relationship to its representations in the Hebrew Bible. In the four decades that have transpired since this interdisciplinary turn in the field, the result has been, to use her words, an ever, quote, more comprehensive picture of Israelite life and beliefs, end of quote, beyond what theological, historical, or literary studies have produced or can produce. In terms of critical dialogue with the social sciences, the person and output of Carol Lyons Myers can only, again, be described as pivotal, a pioneer who put aside disciplinary constrictions and paved the way for the social study of ancient Israel. This optic has marked her work with the texts and remains of antiquity throughout. Through the 1960s and 70s, the ideology of feminism and the field of feminist studies were gradually forged in the struggles of the women's movement for social and cultural equality. The impact on the academy was wide-ranging and far-reaching. Its early stages have long been outlined. In the 1970s, feminism sets out to expose the dynamics and mechanics of patriarchy with a focus on the representation of women by male authors. Thereupon, in the 1980s, feminism turns to the world of women, concentrating on recovering and foregrounding the marginalized lives and roles, works and traditions of women. Such pursuit, along the lines of the second phase of gynocritical criticism, Professor Myers made her own from early on as well, placing it at the forefront of her research into the texts and remains of biblical antiquity. In the interview for Wellesley, she describes the difficulties that she encountered in putting together the new course offering on the Bible and gender, a thorough lack of knowledge regarding the topic, and the total non-existence of a trajectory of scholarly literature. In the later reflection on the intersection of social studies and biblical studies, she cites the ever-expanding volume of work on the relationship of male and female roles in ancient Israel. all of which she traces to the impact and legacy of the women movement of the 1960s and 1970s. She also identifies the direction that such pursuit was to assume in her case, approaching the relationship between the sexes and Israelite origins through the optic of sociocultural approaches, therefore as an aspect of the social structures of Israel. This was for her a way to move beyond the patriarchal slant of the texts, as well as to problematize the ideal representation of parity and gender roles advanced in some texts of the Hebrew Bible. In the 40 years that have passed since the feminist turn in the field, the result has been, to borrow from her words again, an ever more heightened, quote, interest in sexual roles and an evaluation of those roles for the biblical period, end of quote. With respect to critical conversation with feminist studies, the figure and production of Carol Lyons Myers emerges yet again as pivotal. A pioneer who breaks through the discursive limits of gender and leads the way in the analysis of women in the texts and remains of Israel's origins. Out of this project, much distinguished work has flowed from the now classic Discovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in 1988, to the recent Rediscovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in Context of 2012. That Professor Myers has come to such a position at all is incredible. To hear her tell the story, the process has been an entirely fortuitous one. As a young woman growing up in the small town of Kingston in northeastern Pennsylvania and attending a conservative synagogue in Wilkes-Barre across the Susquehanna River, she found the stories of the Bible to be unreal and off-putting. Later on, as a college student at Wellesley, she had declared a major in psychology. When she enrolled in the two-semester course in biblical studies, studies in the Old and New Testament, required at the time. The result was decisive. This curricular experience led her to a view of the Bible as a window to the history, culture, and literature of the times, as well as a change in majors. At about the same time, she signed up for a summer excavation project at the Hell Gap site in Wyoming, sponsored by the Peabody Museum of Harvard University. The result was similarly decisive. Such field experience led her to pursue archaeological studies in conjunction with biblical studies. In preparation for such a course of action, she took a sequence of courses in biblical Hebrew and learned cuneiform on the side. Approaching graduation, she ran against the established tradition in doctoral programs in biblical studies of accepting candidates who had gone to seminary or divinity school and had followed a postgraduate course of studies. However, given her training in languages at Wellesley, this requirement was dropped, and she was admitted at Brandeis, and the rest is history. What she portrays as accidental, however, one could easily read as teleological, if not providential. So it was certainly for biblical studies as well as archaeology, and for the Society of Biblical Literature as well. Over these four decades of reading texts and digging sites, Professor Myers has led our field of studies, broadly writ, forward in multiple ways. All of us in the society and beyond are much the richer and wiser for it. For this, we express our profound gratitude and admiration. We celebrate her election as president, and we await with eager anticipation her presidential address on a topic that brings all of these facets together. Was ancient Israel a patriarchal society? Before she takes the podium, however, there is a tradition of giving a gift, and it is my privilege to do so.
And the scissors.
You go.
Oh, I have to open it?
You?
Oh, well, that's up to you.
Can I wait till later?
You can wait till later.
But you give it to me so you can take the picture.
Without the scissors.
I would like to say that that kind and glowing introduction left me speechless, but I have to give a speech, so I can't do that. No. And I have to say that I couldn't have done all these things without the help and support of a lot of people. Number one, my husband and colleague and co-worker, Eric Myers, who's sitting here front and center. The title of this paper, Was Ancient Israel a Patriarchal Society?, is not a rhetorical question meant to elicit the response, of course ancient Israel was a patriarchal society. Rather, it is a call to re-examine a concept, patriarchy, that has long been used to describe ancient Israel. Since the late 19th century, if not before, the term patriarchy has been invoked to denote the cultural context of biblical texts. And more recently, it frequently appears in feminist discourse that examines and often critiques the presentation of female figures in narratives and other texts in the Hebrew Bible. This concept deserves closer examination for several reasons, not the least of which is the slippery nature of the term itself, which is rarely defined by the biblical scholars who use it. It does not appear in the Hebrew Bible, which does have a vocabulary for family units, but has no term that might be translated patriarchy. Patriarchy, as you'll soon see, is a social science theory rather than a biblical construct. Consequently, its value as a model for understanding any society, let alone an ancient one, must be examined in light of changing perceptions of the patriarchal theory, as well as increased knowledge about the societies to which it is applied. My talk tonight has three parts. In part one, I'll review the use of patriarchy in biblical studies, first in its 19th century origins, and then in its developments in the 20th and 21st century. Briefly review. In part two, I'll consider challenges to the patriarchal model in three areas: classical studies, studies of ancient Israelite women, and feminist theory. And finally, in part three, I have a brief conclusion that includes a suggestion for a different model. First, the matter of definition. It's not really so easy. Patriarchy, as I'm sure you all know, literally is the rule of the father, from the Greek words pater and archo. And it has multiple meanings and is notoriously difficult to define. Some definitions, which claim that women have the status of slaves in a patriarchal system, are clearly harsher than others, which simply refer to male dominance and everything in between. As far as I'm concerned, and at least for the purposes of this paper, a better approach is to acknowledge that patriarchy actually has two manifestations. One is the disproportionate control of the father in families, and second, by extension, the organization of an entire society in ways that exclude women from community roles. And I'll have more to say about these two aspects of it later. Part one, the patriarchal concept in biblical studies. The use of the model in studies of ancient Israel did not emerge in an intellectual vacuum. Rather, it entered the discourse of biblical studies mainly through the lens of anthropology. In the 19th century, with the burgeoning of historical critical biblical studies, some biblical scholars sought to understand social aspects of the world in which the Bible emerged. They were interested in Israelite society, but were frustrated by the incomplete and often contradictory materials in the Hebrew Bible. So they turned to the newly developing social sciences, especially anthropology, for understanding individual households and family structures. This was the first of two waves of biblical scholarship that turned to social science disciplines. The mid-19th century anthropologists to whom biblical scholars turned worked mainly from an evolutionist perspective, assuming that all people's paths passed through stages of development, from the primitive to the civilized. They were especially interested in the development of family structures. Lacking direct evidence of ancient societies, they drew extensively on the material they had, Greek and Latin sources, and also some limited ethnographies. Now, some of these anthropologists argued that matriarchy was the earliest and thus the universal form of the family, but most maintained the absolute opposite view, that the father dominated in the original family form, patriarchy, a term that they used only in relation to families, not to society as a whole. Three figures were especially important in this regard. One is the brilliant English classicist and law professor Henry Sumner Maine. Drawing on Latin sources, his 1861 book on ancient society, which some have likened to Darwin's Origin of the Species in its importance, refers to, quote, the lifelong authority of the father, that's with a capital F, over the person and property of his descendants. He uses the Latin term patria potestis, power of the father for this authority, and he asserts that the father had the power of life and death over his servants, children, and wife. And he calls this paternal despotism, patriarchy. The second figure is a French scholar, Numa Denis Fustel du Coulanges, who also drew on classical texts. In his highly influential 1864 book on ancient society, he emphasizes that the father had absolute and unlimited authority over members of his household. Women, he says, were considered minors and had no household authority. The third figure is the pioneering American anthropologist and lawyer, Lewis Henry Morgan. In his 1877 book, Ancient Society, an Anthropological Classic, he explicitly links the patriarchal family type that he describes, the type of the Greeks and Romans, with its all-powerful father and the concomitant servitude of all other family members. He links that form to what he calls the family type of the Hebrew tribes. His views about paternal power, by the way, influence Marxist doctrines, which in turn influence second-wave feminism. Now, you've already heard about these waves of feminism, but just to make it clear what I mean by these three waves, the first was in relation to the suffrage movement of the 19th and early 20th centuries. The second came with the civil rights movement, as you've heard, of the 60s to 80s. And the third wave, which we're in now, informed by post-colonial and post-modernist theory, began in the early 90s. Now, back to the 19th century anthropologists. Their views about patriarchy entered biblical studies, as far as I can tell, largely through the work of the prominent German historian and theologian Bernhard Stade. His 1887-88 Social History of Ancient Israel, Geschichte des Volkes Israel, may be the first publication in which a biblical scholar uses the terms patriarchy and patriarchal society in reference to ancient Israel. Stade asserts that the Israelite father, paterfamilias, like his Roman counterpart, had enormous power, patria potestas. His reconstruction of Israelite society became a standard work and had significant impact on biblical scholarship, especially in Germany, where Wellhausen was among those influenced by his work. Despite this keen interest of many 19th century biblical scholars in using anthropological research to understand Israelite society, the engagement of biblical scholarship with the social sciences then virtually disappeared for over half a century till the mid-20th century. Many of the assumptions about patriarchal family structure that had characterized the earlier wave of biblical study with social sciences continued in this second wave beginning in the mid-20th century. Examples. In his prestigious Ancient Israel, published first in French in 58 and 60, then in English, and reprinted as a classic in 1997, Roland DeVoe says, quote, there is no doubt that the Israelite family is patriarchal. He goes on to say that men were masters of their wives and had absolute authority over their children, even at times the power of life and death. Major reference works of this era contain similar statements. The entry on family in the 1962 Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible refers to the patriarchal family, which was ruled by the authority of the father. And the entry on Ab, father, in the first volume of the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament, which was the first volume first appeared in German in 1970, it refers to the almost unlimited authority of the father in Israelite families. Another important development in the social sciences came in the mid-20th century when social science approaches in biblical studies began to draw on sociology as well as anthropology. Influenced by Weber's 1922 book, Economy and Society, arguably the most important sociological work of the 20th century, biblical scholars began using patriarchy in an extended sense to refer to society-wide male dominance. Patriarchy became a term for both families and society. Martin Note, for example, was, as many of you I'm sure know, was especially influenced by Weber. In his Geschichte Israels, which became a standard book on Israelite history for generations, certainly one of my texts in college and graduate school, Note asserts that the, quote, family was subject to the patria potestas and that the social order in Israel was patriarchal. Somewhat later, Gottwald's influential Tribes of Yahweh in 1979 refers to the patriarchal nature of Israelite extended families and to the pervasively patriarchal character of Semitic culture. In both examples, patriarchy refers to both the family and to society as a whole. As we move to the end of the 20th and into the 21st century, we see continued adherence to this model, at least with respect to the family. Example, Steger and King's well-received Life in Biblical Israel in 2001 calls the Israelite family patriarchal, with authority resting with the paterfamilias. And the entry on family in the award-winning Pentateuch volume of the Dictionary of the Old Testament in 2003 refers to male dominance, the norm of patriarchy, and the paterfamilias' complete charge of the household. In both instances, the term paterfamilias continues to evoke the old 19th century patriarchal model based on classical texts. Still, adherence to that model did abate somewhat, perhaps because by the end of the 20th century, studies of women's roles in ancient Israel had begun to contest at least certain aspects of the paradigm. Examples. The entry on family in the Anchor Bible Dictionary in 1992 disputes the notion that fathers had absolute authority and rejects the idea that they wielded life-death power over children. A 1993 book on the social world of ancient Israel recognizes significant maternal power and authority in household decisions, and the chapter on the monarchic period in the 1997 book Families in Ancient Israel repudiates both the general notion of paternal supremacy and the idea of the father's life-death powers. The chapter on ancient Israelite families in the 2003 anthology Marriage and Family in the Biblical World is even stronger. It takes to task those who consider biblical narratives to be expressions of patriarchy, asserts that father does not mean ruler, and proposes that the term patriarchy be avoided altogether. Nevertheless, it is striking that this somewhat diminished appeal to the model has found little resonance among many feminist biblical scholars. Examples, the introduction to a 1999 reader on women in the Hebrew Bible asserts that biblical texts function to preserve patriarchal society. In a 2006 book on gender in the Hebrew Bible, this book calls the social, economic, and political systems of ancient Israel patriarchal and hierarchical, arrangement that worked to, quote, benefit men directly and to benefit their families only at the father's pleasure. Even the introduction to the new 2012 edition of the acclaimed Women's Bible Commentary refers to the patriarchal assumptions of the society around the text. And perhaps the most pointed assertion comes in a year 2000 book that calls patriarchy, quote, the fundamental social system of ancient Israel. And this book proclaims that biblical texts are anchored in a particular ideology of male domination, and they promote a male supremacist social and cognitive system. Note that the patriarchal model appropriated by these feminist critiques is this expanded version, the concept of a system of pervasive male privilege in the family and society. In using this expanded version, they are following in the footsteps of second wave feminist theorists. Those theorists insisted that patriarchy is more than the father's decision-making power. Remember, they're influenced by Weber. More than the father's decision-making power over all aspects of family life, but rather consist of social structures and ideologies that have enabled men to dominate and exploit women throughout recorded history, with all men having power to exploit and use women. In this discourse of second-wave feminist theorists, patriarchy certainly means all-pervasive domination, and many feminist biblical scholars apparently follow their lead. In sum, the anthropological concept of patriarchy taken up by Hebrew Bible scholars in the 19th century still influences the understanding of Israelite households. We see the continued appearance of terms like Latin terms, pater familias, pater potestas, and the all-inclusive concept of male dominance and concomitant female victimhood as articulated by second-wave feminist theorists appears in publications of feminist biblical scholars. But is this persistent appeal to the patriarchal model justified? Perhaps not. Its appropriateness to describe Israelite society can be challenged, which is what I'm going to do with you right now, challenged in three areas. First, classical studies. I'll report on what's going on there. Second, research on Israelite and biblical women, which have been what I've been doing for a long time. And then third wave feminist theory. So classical studies. Because the patriarchal concept originated in analyses of ancient Greek and Latin sources, challenges to those analyses are especially significant. Already in the 1960s, it was noted that the all-powerful pater familias of Rome is too crude a figure to correspond to the nuances of reality, and that different areas of household life cannot be lumped together. That is, male control in one area does not necessarily mean male control in all areas. Another development came several decades later, when the reality of the father's life and death power was shown to be an abstract concept and not a fact of social history. Perhaps the most thorough discrediting of the patriarchal paradigm in classical studies came in the 1990s, when it became clear that new knowledge about the social realities and cultural representations of classical civilizations would not support the traditional depiction of patriarchy. Roman historian Richard Saller has been instrumental in this regard. He recognizes that most of the 19th century theorists based their analyses on ancient legal texts, which they erroneously believed functioned in the same way that American and British legal systems do. It is no accident that two of the three 19th century anthropologists I mentioned were also lawyers. They ignored evidence in other, dumping on lawyers, right? They ignored evidence in other sources and thus missed information in those other sources about the realities of ancient life. Examining a broad range of non-legal classical texts has since revealed aspects of daily life in which fathers do not exercise absolute authority. As Saller says, quote, "The stark image of the severe, all-powerful, despotic father and husband is an exaggerated, misunderstood, and misleading construct that too easily ignores the complexities of human relationships in everyday life. He calls that image the stuff of legendary caricature, not to be mistaken for sociological description, and he asserts that it's a gross oversimplification to represent Roman fathers as having unlimited power." It's especially important to note that the relationship between a man and his wife in Roman society did not involve the same authority that a father may have had over his children. Roman women often had household power and authority. They managed property and exercised power over their dependents. Note that Xenophon's treatise on Greek household management presents the economic roles of wife and husband as complementary, with a woman having household authority and sometimes extending that even over her marital partner. That depiction find support in the analysis of Roman and Greek household space by third-wave feminist archaeologists who have challenged the traditional concept of sequestered, powerless women by providing evidence of female control of significant aspects of family life. Classicists have also challenged the expanded view of patriarchy as absolute male control over society-wide institutions. Surely, of course, men had undeniably more numerous and more visible roles in community life. But women were not categorically excluded. Religious roles in particular have been the subject of considerable research, and classicists have shown that ancient Greek women took part in public religious activities, arguably an arena of politics, and held leadership positions in certain cults or festivals. And Roman women were all actively involved as participants or even officiants in mainstream public cults, not simply marginal women's cults. Also, archaeological materials, both iconography and inscriptions, depict women in a variety of community roles, roles that are far less visible in literary texts. Now, I want to be clear, this recent classical scholarship does not claim equality for women, but rather it contests the use of the patriarchy concept, which originated in 19th century scholarship based on limited sources. Now, using a variety of sources, classical scholarship has problematized the patriarchal designation. In studies of Israelite women, examining the patriarchy paradigm as used for ancient Israel poses problems not present for classicists. Like classical sources, the Hebrew Bible is mostly the product of urban male elites. However, unlike classical texts, the Bible took shape many centuries after the existence of the society depicted in many of its passages. Moreover, it's just one document, a rich one, of course, whereas classical scholars can consult many, many different works spanning centuries. So the study of Israelite society, especially family life, means using some biblical materials, inevitably, but also archaeological data, which can certainly supplement and even challenge the impression one gets from texts alone. The relevant archaeological materials come from the excavation of households, the setting in which most people, women and men, experience daily life. However, raw archaeological data do not themselves indicate the dynamics of household life. They must be interpreted. And the interpretive lens is provided by what we call gender archaeology, which is concerned with people, not only their artifacts and dwellings. It seeks to identify aspects of gendered life in the past, notably by redirecting the traditional focus on men's activities and roles to those of women. Also, its insistence on discovering the relationships of women with others, it often contests facile claims based only on texts about female subordination. In so doing, it also often disputes common assumptions about social systems, not only household life. Interpreting the remains of households provides information about the lived experience of their inhabitants. For example, archaeologists discover the tools of daily life, but gender attribution, determining whether women or men were more likely to have used the tools, means consulting ethnographic data and also textual references and iconographic depictions. Furthermore, once women's tasks are identified, assessing how those tasks are valued in their own society relies on evidence from traditional societies, not on how those tasks might be viewed in today's industrialized societies. So what did women contribute to household life? Well, the tasks of women and men overlapped in certain circumstances, but they were not the same. Women were responsible for what gender archaeologists call maintenance activities, and that's a term used for the set of practices and experiences concerning the sustenance, welfare, and long-term reproduction of the household. Many of these practices required specialized knowledge and were essential to sustain, regulate, and stabilize both household and community life. They include economic, social, political, and religious activities, way too many to be considered here. And now I will refer you to my most recent book, Rediscovering Eve, where I go into details about all these aspects of women's maintenance activities. But right now, I'll just mention briefly some economic activities that leave traces in the archaeological record and can be interpreted with respect to gender roles and relationships. Economic activities were an integral part of household life, and it can be shown that women were largely responsible for food processing, textile production, and the fashioning of many household implements and containers. Women's role in commodity production was essential for survival. Ethnographic evidence strongly suggests that when women dominate these indispensable household processes, they are positioned to exercise a certain amount of household power. Those responsible for preparing life-sustaining food, for example, have a say in household activities relating to both production and consumption. They also control allocation of household space and implements. In short, depending on their age and experience, older Israelite women had managerial roles, supervising the assignment of tasks as well as the use of resources. They were kind of like COOs, chief operating officers in their households. They were hardly oppressed and powerless, nor were they subordinate to male control in all aspects of household life. And in a subsistence household in traditional societies comparable to ancient Israel, when women and men both make significant economic contributions to household life, female-male relationships are marked by interdependence or mutual dependence. So for most but not all processes in ancient Israelite households, the marital union should be seen more of a partnership than as one of subordination or dominance. Not for all functions, but for many. Household life had different gendered components, and they cannot be lumped together. Again, men dominate some aspects of household life, but not all, women others. There are also some biblical sources that actively support this conclusion about the managerial agency of women, despite the androcentric perspective of the text. Women's household agency can be seen in several narratives, in Proverbs, and in some legal stipulations of the covenant code. Just a couple examples. The story of Micah's mother in Judges 17 shows a senior woman's decision-making power, her right to perform certain religious acts and to commission cultic objects that increase the value of the household shrine. A woman in an affluent household, Abigail in 1 Samuel 25, has access to resources that she uses cleverly to save her household from David's wrath. And she acts on her own initiative without consulting her husband, gives orders to servants, speaks with the wise and diplomatic rhetoric of a woman accustomed to being in charge. Another woman, the Shunammite of 2 Kings 4 and 8, acts autonomously when she invites the prophet Elisha to her house, when she reconfigures household space, moves her family away during a drought, interacts with the king as well as the prophet, and negotiates the restoration of property taken over by squatters when the family is away. In Proverbs, the strong woman of Proverbs 31 is an efficient, Eshet Chayil, an efficient and successful household manager and businesswoman, exhibiting resourcefulness and acumen in economic processes. And several covenant code stipulations in Exodus 21 mandate punishment for offspring, presumably the adult children in complex families, who strike or curse their parents. In other words, the household authority of mother as well as father over dependents is upheld. In some gender archaeology and biblical texts together provide compelling evidence for the managerial power of at least some Israelite women in the household setting. So the term patriarchy as a designation of general male domination and the oppression of women would thus be inappropriate and inaccurate. Identifying female agency challenges the idea embedded in the patriarchal model that women were helpless victims of a male dominant system. One can say the same by looking at the wider community role for women, and here we look only at biblical texts and see if the certain references can be trusted, that women were not excluded from all professional roles either. I've counted up about 20 different community roles mentioned for women in the Hebrew Bible. And I'm certainly not going to go through all that literature, but you know about many of them, leadership positions such as judge and sage, the royal woman who exercised power as Gibirot, queen mothers, because of their class as much as their gender. Women contributed to the cultural realm in several ways as poets, if you can trust the fact that some poems and songs are attributed to women, as performers, there are references to female singers, dancers, and instrumentalists, and there as mourning women. Some of these cultural roles certainly can be considered secular, but others, such as the victory songs praising God's salvific acts, and perhaps the funerary laments, were in the realm of religion. And there are other religious roles, including the menial ones of the women, enigmatic women, at the entrance to the tent of meeting, and cultic ones, such as in Ezekiel, where women, along with male priests, carry out a complex of ritual activities. And then there are the authoritative religious roles, notably by women prophets. The four named ones, Deborah, Miriam, Huldah, and Noadiah, the two unnamed ones, and then all those probably subsumed under the masculine plural noun, Nevi'im, prophets. Now, most of these professional women had considerable expertise and made significant contributions to their communities, provided authoritative services. They were hardly dominated by male hierarchies. Moreover, those who worked within female cohorts, like the performers or lamenters or certain prophets, had their own hierarchies, with senior women or those with greatest expertise dominating and teaching the less skilled women or apprentices, some of them perhaps their own daughters. So patriarchy as a society-wide designation, implying that women were completely excluded from community positions, also seems inappropriate and incorrect. Now, feminist critiques, third wave. Many concerns about the patriarchal paradigm have been raised by third wave feminist scholars. Their discussion of patriarchy, which strives to correct the essentialist, absolutist, and dichotomizing tendencies of the second wave theorists, are far too extensive. You should breathe a sigh of relief for me to recount here. But I will mention some of the most salient issues. One is the fundamental problem is that the idea of patriarchy rests on a naturalized view of women as inferior to men and thus incapable of making decisions, controlling resources, or providing leadership. For example, Weber, whom I mentioned before, linked male dominance to, quote, the normal superiority of the physical and intellectual energies of the male. Residues of such flawed, I hope you'll agree, essentialist views underlie notions of patriarchy and I think weaken the legitimacy of the model. A closely related problem is the assumption of patriarchy's universality, that it existed everywhere across time and space. Ethnographers have been instrumental in showing that the range of women's activities and the degree of their social and economic power actually vary enormously across cultures. So the idea of absolute male dominance everywhere cannot be uncritically superimposed on all societies as a universal and natural condition. Another problem is that the patriarchal model rests on a male-female dichotomy. When concepts of sexuality as a binary are deconstructed and wider variability and fluidity in sexual identity and practices are acknowledged, the root binary of patriarchy is disrupted. Also, applying the patriarchal label to traditional societies generally means applying the values of capitalist societies, values that valorize male individuality. In so doing, the importance of women's social and economic contributions in traditional societies, which are much less individualistic, goes unrecognized. Another thing is that the notion of biological paternity forming the foundation of society-wide dominance, which goes back to Weber, as I've explained, but this link between fatherhood in a kinship group and male rule in a polity is now seen by third-wave feminist critics, to be neither necessary nor universal. Another thing, the patriarchy paradigm assumes that household dynamics are monolithic, but specific forms of male dominance cannot be generalized as indicators, as I've already indicated, of total male control. Feminist archaeologists have documented the disconnect between putative ideologies of male dominance and the diversity and fluidity of actual gender practices. Another thing, the concept of patriarchy renders the past static by superimposing the notion of a fixed set of statuses and relationships upon a lived reality that inevitably involves subtle and shifting patterns. Similarly, it renders invisible the multiple ways in which women are social actors, ways not always visible in a society's normative documents. Actual gender practices are distinct from patriarchal gender ideology, if there even is such a thing. Another thing, I'm getting near the end of these things. The patriarchal model involves a unidimensional concentration on gender in its characterization of both families and societies. And I think this may be the most important thing, because it thereby neglects other forms of social asymmetry, those linked to social class, race, ethnicity, sexuality, or age. These other forms of social asymmetry that disadvantage many men as well as women. Feminist theorists thus emphasize that analyzing power relations means taking into account the complex intersection of the various dimensions of a person's identity and also acknowledging the subordinate status of many men as well as women in relation to these other categories. Invoking patriarchy means considering women helpless victims, and thus it effaces the many ways in which women circumvent or foil mechanisms of power. And finally, proclaiming that women in an ancient non-Western society were oppressed in a patriarchal system arguably encodes a belief in the cultural superiority of modern democracies. Altogether, these problems mean that, as one theorist proclaims, the discourse of patriarchy requires a feminist post-structuralist overhaul. Thus, a far more complex model is required to represent the mutable dynamics of the lived experiences of individuals across the social and political system of Israelite society. Now, my brief conclusion beyond patriarchy will suggest what that model might be. But first, let me remind you that, as I pointed out, much biblical scholarship, especially but not exclusively feminist biblical scholarship, even today, as I've shown, continues to consider ancient Israel a patriarchal society. Moreover, the term patriarchy, although rarely articulated, typically assumes both male dominance of the household and in society-wide functions. Largely unrecognized by biblical scholars is the fact that the patriarchy concept, formed by anthropologists in the 19th and early 20th centuries, is not holding up very well in classical studies and in feminist theory. Furthermore, the roles of Israelite women, as I tried to show, can be recovered through using the interpretive processes of gender archaeology as well as by attending to certain biblical texts. Close examination of those roles indicates that the patriarchal concept occludes the presence of significant domains of female agency in both household and society-wide contexts in ancient Israel. I think it's time for us to acknowledge that patriarchy is a Western constructed concept and not a social law. As a constructed model, it is essentially an oversimplification and a systemization of data to be used for comparative purposes. And as for all such models, constructed models, new information can and should mean that it has outlived its usefulness. It is my contention that it no longer provides a valid heuristic formulation for representing Israelite society. It just isn't flexible enough to accommodate the reality of daily household activities and interactions, and it interferes with attempts to understand the complex gendered patterns of life in ancient Israel, and in doing so, it presents an unduly negative view of women's lives in the biblical past. And it obscures the existence of groups such as servants, slaves, non-Israelites, whose members probably led far more circumscribed lives than did most women. Let me be perfectly clear. In eschewing the patriarchal model, I am not arguing for the existence of gender equality in ancient Israel. Israelite patrilineality, for example, clearly favored men in the transmission of a household's inheritance across generations through male lines, a pattern that undoubtedly underlies the male control of female sexuality that appears in biblical texts and also in ethnographic observations of traditional societies. But patrilineality is not the same as patriarchy. And male control of female sexuality, repugnant as it may seem to us in the modern world, does not mean male control of adult women in every aspect of household or community life. In short, male dominance was real, but it was fragmentary, not hegemonic. I began with a question, remember, asking if ancient Israel was a patriarchal society, and my answer, as you have heard, is no, ancient Israel should not be called a patriarchal society because that term, patriarchy, is an inadequate and misleading designation for the social reality of ancient Israel. I will conclude with another question and a very brief suggestion as a reply. Is there another social science model that can perhaps better accommodate the diversity of women's experiences and acknowledge their control of certain household and society-wide functions if the patriarchal model can't do that? And my suggested answer to that question is a more recent social science model. Many anthropologists now invoke the concept of heterarchy, a concept that concedes the existence of hierarchies. You know, it's not proclaiming equality or egalitarianism, but it does not situate them all in a linear fashion. Rather, it acknowledges that different power structures can exist simultaneously in any given society, with each structure having its own hierarchical arrangements. As a far more flexible model than patriarchy, it is a heuristic tool that I think can better accommodate, at least for now, until another tool comes along, the complex gender dynamics, and thus allow us to acknowledge that Israelite women were not dominated in all aspects of life, but were autonomous actors in multiple aspects of household and community life. Thank you for your attention.